Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, Trish, I've got midlife rage about something my teenagers have done. And it's but so infuriating.
Go on, what is it?
They've been putting packets back into the fridge that are empty. So my fruit and nut, my Cadbury's fruit and nut chocolate, which I look forward to, you go into the fridge empty. After eight mints, which I save for special occasions, like an old lady, empty box.
Yeah.
And my rich tea biscuits that I dunk in my tea in the morning, I only have one. I think there is some. Are some? Is some? No.
But the sort of scrappy packet has been left, the empty packet. They do. And I tell you what they also do is they leave a tiny little dribble in the bottle of the orange juice bottle. And the almond milk, every time I pick it up, there's just the tiniest little splash in the bottom. And I'm like, either drink the blooming thing or put it in the recycling.
Well, they leave the splash because they don't put it in the recycling. Yeah, they can't be bothered. They're too lazy. This is like, this is a new game. It's called Teenager Top Trumps, isn't it? Trumping you with their irritating behaviour. Okay. Well, we do love them though, don't we?
Oh, we do.
Hello.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife.
I'm Lorraine Candy.
And I'm Trish Halpin, and we're here to share everything we know and have learned about being in our marvellous midlife.
Yes, we'll be celebrating the highs as well as laughing and sometimes crying through the lows about all the issues that affect women at this stage of life, from sleep and sex to parenting and the perils of perimenopause.
Welcome, everyone. We are well into series 3 of Postcards from Midlife, and we wanted to thank you, actually, for taking the time to tell us about your personal midlife journeys.
Yes, we're excited to be heading into 2021 with such a positive, smart, witty group of women alongside us who this week have personally contributed to the show.
Indeed, that's right, Trish. So today we will be tackling a subject which provokes much debate in midlife, and that is our relationship with booze, with alcohol, with cocktails, with gin and tonics. We will be asking if Generation X has discovered midlife moderation, a subject that got you all talking on our Facebook group, and we'll be discussing your stories here.
Yes, we'll be jibber-jabbering about how attitudes to alcohol change as we age and wondering if midlife means we can finally flip the self-control switch.
And later on in the programme, we meet a guest whose midlife meltdown led to a rebirth that we can all benefit from. Health and fitness coach Amanda Thebe will be showing us how to get the best out of our mind and bodies as we age. Her new book, Menopocalypse... See what she did there? Explains why we should be changing our exercise goals and defining a healthier diet in midlife. So are you ready to shake it up a bit, Trish? Do you want to try some weightlifting?
I might need a new leotard, though.
Well, a weightlifting leotard, like Big Daddy's.
I have to grow some hair on my chest. And actually, talking of hair... This is our what would you do dilemma, because we're going to be asking, should it stay or should it go?
Hair.
And yes, I mean pubic hair. I'm going to say the word pubic hair. And that was also prompted by a post on the Facebook group.
And finally, how good are you with family finances? In our How to Win at Midlife section, we sort out our attitude to midlife money and help to plan a fun and financially secure Act 2 and 3. Okay, dear listeners, we are just taking a moment. We are pausing in our broadcast for Trish to go upstairs out of her basement recording studio and take her thermal vest off.
I'm overheating.
Why did you put a thermal vest on in the first place?
Well, because it's cold, isn't it? And I'm too mean to have the heating on in the house in the day. So just get the old Uniqlo thermal vests out. They're brilliant.
staging a fashion intervention for you there, Trish. Right. Do not wear thermal vests.
Okay, fair enough. Right, I think we need to move on, because it's jibber-jabber time. And I think this is a really interesting one. I think we've all got a point of view on this because it's about our relationship with alcohol. And obviously, as young women, we love to go out and party. We enjoy drinking. We might have got drunk ever so occasionally with friends. But as we get older and our bodies are less able to metabolize alcohol effectively, we've had to become much more sensible and take a healthier approach to alcohol, but that can be really difficult. I mean, I know I've found that quite difficult, and especially for someone like you, Lorraine, when you're a party girl at heart.
I am indeed. I think midlife, it was a bit of a shock suddenly losing my tolerance to alcohol. This is a physiological thing. It happens to nearly all women, doesn't it? As your estrogen and testosterone, your hormone levels drop, you are unable to metabolize it. And it seems to happen very suddenly. Suddenly, one morning, one evening, you have one glass of wine and you're dizzy and you can't, and the hangovers are epic and go on for ages. We didn't really expect to lose our tolerance to alcohol, I don't think. And this happens during perimenopause. So we'd probably never questioned or worried about what our attitude to midlife alcohol would be. And a lot of my friends are either drastically cutting back or going completely sober or completely changing the way they drink and what they drink. But it is really woven into the fabric of our lives, particularly in the UK, I think. Not just because we want to get drunk, but because it's what happens when we socialise.
So, and if you have a partner who drinks and doesn't want to, isn't kind of that interested, you know, Neil does like the odd beer or two or three or four or five, and that can be really difficult as well if you're trying to cut down and stop.
Yeah, I have a friend who has a new partner in midlife after a divorce who is completely teetotal because he's a reformed alcoholic. So he's dealing with an addiction. So she has a very low tolerance to it now, she's Scottish, having had a very high tolerance to alcohol before. So she has completely given up alongside him. And it's meant that she's had to change everything in a way. She's had to change who she sees. She's had friends say to her, well, you're just going to be boring now. There's no point going out. Mm. It really does make you review everything. And during the pandemic, there was a big piece in The Guardian actually recently that it was the over 50s. Who were drinking more, who were binge drinking. So it was affecting them the most. I do think it is a Generation X issue in many ways because millennials don't tend to go out to get completely hammered. That doesn't tend to be in the cultural psyche of that generation that kind of comes after us. I'm perplexed as to what to do about it because a part of me feels that I'd actually quite like to give up for a sustained amount of time. So there is something called the 100-day challenge. I'd quite like to try that and see how I feel. And then I think, is moderation not better? Is it not better to say I will only drink on a Friday or have one glass of open wine?
I'm very good at moderation, as you know, in general. But with alcohol, I find it quite challenging because even though I'm good at moderating, I still have in my head, like when it's a Sunday, oh, it's four more days till I can have a drink because I'm like, I have a drink on a Thursday night. And I'm literally every day I'm thinking, oh, it's three more days till I can have a glass of wine. So even though I might only be having two glasses of wine on a Thursday, a gin and a wine on a Friday, and maybe a beer on a Saturday, I still really think about it. It's kind of there, and it's this sort of motivation factor. And for me, I don't like that. So I'm actually, for the first time ever, I'm doing dry January, and I've never done them before because I've always thought I don't need to because I don't drink huge amounts. And I am quite, but I just don't like this.
Like a drink, no, Trish. I do.
Like a drink, and I have my moments, but I wouldn't get like drunk every week these days because of the reasons that we've talked about, of the impact that it has. So I just want to know that I can stop. So so I am doing dry January, and going well so far. Neil's doing it with me, which I think is an important one.
Well, I see, from my point of view though, I've always done dry January more or less every time, and then I've done these daft detoxes and things that I've written about for the various magazines I've worked in, where I've gone 6 to 8 weeks without drinking and followed new diet and things like that. So I don't find it hard to give up when I'm giving up, but when I'm drinking, I think I probably drink too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think at this age for what is healthy for my
body.
And there's the whole sort of issue of grey drinking, isn't there? And we've had some really amazing responses on to the post on the Facebook group. And I think it's got one of the most number of responses since we started the group about the attitude to moderating alcohol. And I think you spoke to somebody, or you saw Sarah Williamson, yes, who calls herself a grey area drinking coach. She got in touch with you, didn't she?
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I would say three people got in touch via Facebook or email as grey area drinking coach, which is a new phenomenon, something I hadn't heard of before. So I've cut down Sarah's post that she sent us on Facebook, because she then followed up with an email. So she says, I'm 41. About 3 years ago, I decided to give alcohol a bit less room in my life. I'd considered myself a normal drinker, a G&T or two on a Thursday night while cooking, a couple of glasses of wine on Friday, a couple of glasses on a Saturday. This is considered low risk drinking. It is actually, if you follow the guidelines, the UK guidelines. But she says, on nights out with my girlfriends, which was about once a month, I would drink a lot more than that, always ending up with me bouncing off hedges on the way home and a hangover from hell for the next 2 days. Moderating my alcohol consumption was not something I could do. It took me 3 years, she says, to accept that. So she stopped drinking in 2019, setting a clear goal and reasons around why she'd stopped drinking, taking time to understand her mindset and all her habits around alcohol consumption, what triggered her and how to deal with the cravings. This is the interesting bit for me. She says, I used to think of myself as an extrovert, but since I stopped drinking, I've come to realise that I'm actually quite a happy introvert. And there is a theory, isn't there, that a lot of the drinking is to distract you from the feeling because you can't really think about things in depth if you're just a bit tipsy or tiddly. So there's you could be someone different to who you are, and the drinking is masking it. That's, I guess, that's part of the addiction theory in a way, or the helping yourself theory.
Exactly. She goes on, doesn't she, to talk about becoming a grey drinking coach and running programs. But there's also an interesting book by Katie Bailey and Mandy Manners called Love Yourself Sober, which is also a self-care guide for many grey area drinkers across the UK. And apparently there are 10 million of us Brits who have something called alcohol use disorder, which is essentially grey area drinking.
But what does that mean? You can't get it in your mouth properly, alcohol use disorder.
Exactly. And not very many of those people are seeking help. But there are things to help you. So you can look at grey area drinking coaching. You can get a book like that. And there's apps as well. There's one that Public Health England have got called Drink Free Days, which is obviously a free one to download. And that's really good because it helps you sort of make a pledge, and you can monitor what you're drinking, and it gives you lots of advice and different things like that. So that's quite a good one. I think maybe if you've tried the Dry Januaries and they aren't doing it for you, something like that might be quite good.
I think at this stage in life, though, some people, when they try Dry January, and this came up on the Facebook group, they try Dry January and then just don't start again because their life has changed as a result of it. And it's more about going for walks, doing different things, that you're changing the way you used to drink. But then part of me feels, why would you give something you like up completely if it isn't affecting your health? What that seems kind of martyrish in a way. There was one post on Facebook which I thought was really good, where the woman said, her rule is, did I drink yesterday? So if I drank yesterday, I won't drink today, which is better than maybe setting this 4-day, 3-day thing that makes you look forward to things. Maybe that's the wrong way going around and about it.
Yeah, so I think it'll be interesting to see. We'll report back on how we get on with our moderation with my Dry January. And I think
I'm teetering on the brink of the 100-day challenge.
Yeah, and then just one last plea. I think for all of those awful people who do those greeting cards with all the kind of mummy wine time, wine o'clock, gin, all of that, just stop now.
Stop
enough.
It.
It's not funny. It's not clever.
No, it's not. Gin didn't get me through parenting 4 small children at all. It's ridiculous.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now it's time to meet our guest, Amanda Thieb. She is a health and fitness expert whose down-to-earth approach to wellness helps women get the best out of their bodies. As a successful personal trainer, she was completely thrown by her perimenopause when she suddenly experienced crippling exhaustion, depression, and mystery migraines, and was mistakenly prescribed antidepressants. Now aged 49, Amanda is happier and healthier than ever and has written a no-nonsense guide to getting your midlife mojo back. Menopocalypse, How I Learned to Thrive During Menopause. So, welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Amanda.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, you live in Texas, sunny Texas, where your husband works. You're a mum to two children, two boys, aged 13 and 17, and you've been a personal trainer for more than 20 years. Were you surprised or taken by surprise by the perimenopause?
Was I surprised when the wrecking ball smacked me in the face and ruined my life for 2 years? Yeah. It was something like that.
It was quite dramatic, wasn't it? In your book, you do go into it in detail.
Yeah, and you know, like, it's actually coming up to 30 years I've been doing this, because I've actually gone back in time. I actually started like personal training in my 20s and I've just turned 50. So, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I feel like I'm pretty well educated in physiology of the body, the nutrition and general health, that I can have a good conversation about all of those things.
Yeah.
But there's nothing ever spoken about menopause or perimenopause in my world at all. And so when I started to feel unwell, age 42, it just came out the blue and I had no idea. And then just to spend 2 years feeling really unwell and not recognizing myself, despite seeing doctors who really wanted to help me, nobody ever told me that these were hormonal issues I was having.
But they were quite dramatic. I mean, they were intense migraines and you were exhausted for days, weren't you? And you were in Canada at the time, I think, and you were offered antidepressants. They were so extreme, your symptoms.
Yeah, and I was offered antidepressants because nobody recognized they were perimenopause, definitely. And my symptoms were migraines, which were also misdiagnosed because my migraines didn't come with a headache. I had vestibular migraines. So I struggled with vertigo, nausea. I actually lost feeling in one side of my face and down to my arm. I thought I was having a stroke, and I would like go to my husband and go, do you think I'm having a stroke? Look at my face. Is it drooping? And I didn't recognize myself, and the fatigue that I had was like, I hear women say this all the time, I would be like on the sofa for days. And this was not like me at all. I really didn't recognize myself.
And how did you resolve this? How did you match it all up, do the jigsaw?
Yeah, it wasn't me. I went to my annual, like, well woman, I suppose you call it, like, exam, and my gynecologist said, is everything okay? And so I started crying, like you do when you're feeling terrible. And he just said, listen, these are known symptoms of perimenopause. I can help you. You're clearly struggling with depression too. And that sort of made a lot of sense. And I just was like, oh, I'm so glad I know now. And that was like the start of me being able to put the pieces together again.
It must have been such a relief. How did your kind of family behave around you and your husband in particular? Because I think the understanding of our families and for men to know about this as well, it's just so important, isn't it?
Well, it's really challenging because you're in a situation where you yourself don't know what's going on, right? Mm. So I had like 2 years of not being the person they knew and recognized. I've been with my husband like 20 years. And then I'm expecting them to respond appropriately to this new personality. So they were very kind and empathetic, but they were lost, completely lost. And in fact, after I'd had my appointment with the gynecologist, my husband met me for lunch and just said, what did he say? And I went, oh, it's perimenopause and I'm struggling with depression and migraines. And he went, oh, thank God for that. I thought you were going to leave me. And it was just
That's such a common story that we hear all the time. It's really sad. It's breaking point, isn't it, for women? Breaking point.
Well, look at the divorce rates during that time as well.
Yeah.
It peaks, right? It's not unique. My story isn't unique at all.
And are you on HRT? What was the solution medically to your issues?
So again, my gynecologist, pretty well educated, because we know not all gynecologists are, but he was. He offered me hormone replacement therapy, and 8 years ago I was like, I don't think so. You're trying to give me breast cancer. It was exactly the place my mind went. And he offered me antidepressants. And the antidepressants he offered me after my refusal of HRT were ones where the off-label benefits could help me with my migraines and depression.
Right.
So I took those, and I took them for, I think, 18 months. And they actually did work for me until the point when I started getting other symptoms that were hormonally related, obviously, yes. and the antidepressants. So I did go on HRT, and unfortunately, I'm one of those people that really hasn't had a good time with HRT. I'm a proponent of it, and I want women all to be given the choice to be able to take it, but not everybody responds perfectly to it, and I feel good on it for a while and then I don't, and I end up having, I've been on everything out there, and currently I'm not on anything, and I'm a bit frustrated about it, but
it's just a long journey, isn't it?
It's a long journey.
So your book is really specifically aimed at women in menopause, perimenopause and midlife, and it extols the virtues of strength training for women. So can you explain what strength training is, because I just think weights, and does it mean that someone like me and Trish, we don't have to do those HIIT classes anymore, which exhaust us and must be going to break my knees at some point?
You know, I come from a bias because I'm a strength coach, obviously. One of the things that literally saved my sanity through all of this was strength trainings. And I'm going to talk about the benefits, but strength training is putting a force on the body that creates a stimulus. So what that would be is that, say, like you have a pair of dumbbells and you do a chest press, you're lying on a bench and you push the weights up. I'm doing it like everyone can do it with me. And what happens is when you do something with resistance, so you're creating a movement that you have to push against a load, what that does is it creates a stimulus in the body at a cellular level. And to what extent that reflects on the body is, it's, there's so many different benefits. So initially what it will do is it will pull against, the muscle pulls away from the bone and it sort of damages the muscle somewhat. That's actually what you're looking for, these micro tears. And then they rebuild in your recovery and rest period to create a stronger muscular frame on the body. How that would look is, as opposed to a HIIT training where you go into a class and you're just like on, and that's like the beat of the music too.
I don't like that.
But there's very little rest and there's very, very little education behind it. It literally is you working in an anaerobic threshold. Anaerobic means at your highest capacity without oxygen usually. Think about going for a walk. That's an aerobic exercise. Yeah. And your aerobic means you're using oxygen through in the blood through to the heart. Anaerobically means that you're working sort of without oxygen and you're working at your peak. And you know, some of that inner workout is beneficial. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But when you're in that like on state for 45 minutes, you're in a place that's catabolic. I'm using all of these terms and I'm trying to like relate these to everything we know, but think about catabolic meaning it breaks you down. And then when you break down, you have to build back up. Well, when you're in a prolonged state of being in a catabolic mode, it's really hard to recover. And what most women,
if you're older, I'm guessing.
Well, it's not just the strain on the body, but it's just like when you, especially when you've gone through perimenopause, like you're in a high cortisol state, your body's in a bit of a higher breakdown state, and you're just adding more stress to that.
Yeah.
You're jumping about and it's just not the best thing that the body needs right now. But if you go into a pure strength training class where you're lifting weights and you're creating a stimulus into the body, you recover a lot quicker from that, but the benefits are higher. So the body requires you, as you get older, to maintain your muscle mass. And I don't mean like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, your body has muscle, right? It has it right now. You have fat, you have muscle. And as you age, it sort of dies down. Like you start to lose.
You say that muscle mass goes down by about 3% every year after the age of 30, don't you? So that's what we're facing. So after the age of 40, we've got less and it's gradually decreasing.
And that's
the strength training is building the muscle mass back into us.
It's actually like maintaining what you've got and potentially building more. Yeah. And it's super, super hard to get big and bulky lifting weights. It's super hard. Like even if you started like juicing.
So we couldn't put Trish on a weightlifting course and have her looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It would take a lot of work.
Weeks.
Yeah, it takes a lot of effort. But if you did a strength training course for 6 weeks, I think you would see some huge benefits. And the benefits, which I think that the selling points of strength training are, if you work hard enough in a strength training session, you're working aerobically anyway, you should get out of breath. So you sort of get in the benefits that you want to feel, that those endorphin highs you get from HIIT, which is what women crave, right? You're going to get those anywhere. And they release serotonin and they also release dopamine. And so you get these feel good hormones anyway. And they can be a lifesaver for women. Mm-hmm. You're going to maintain and build lean muscle, which we know can help with your health markers like your insulin sensitivity, cardiovascular health, osteoporosis. That stimulus I said that it creates can help build and maintain bone health. It's one of our biggest health issues for postmenopause. And then it sort of builds this unique strength that's really hard to describe, but it's empowering.
We're doing it every day, or we're doing an hour every 3 days? What's your rough?
Yeah, you don't need to do it every day. So I am, and this isn't just my recommendation, this is what the studies have shown. There's tons and tons of studies for strength training. 3 to 4 times a week is enough. 3 times a week should be a goal for most women. And if you work hard enough in and sensibly enough in that time, you can have a workout done within 30 to 40 minutes. And the programs I write in my book are full body programs, and it's like functional training. Women may have heard of that, which means you use the full body all the time. I'm a bit of a drill sergeant when it comes to form, because what happens as we age, you were saying your knees are hurting. I mean, that's just years of like maybe doing things with bad posture, or, you know, just wear and tear. Generally, wear and tear starts to show. And as we start to age, if we do strength training, it sort of bulletproofs our body. It helps us rebound quicker. You know, like if you have injuries and you're doing strength training, the chances are you're going to recover a lot quicker.
If you're not familiar with strength training, if you haven't done it, there are particular types of classes, because I do something called a body pump class. That is strength training, isn't it? How would you recommend starting and going about it?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's really hard for women to sort of actually specifically know, right? So it's easy for me to say, yeah, just go strength training, because it's all I've ever done. But one, like, there's a confidence issue. Women feel like it's something that they can't do because maybe they've lost belief in their athletic ability, or they just don't know how to start. And so I feel there's an entry level for every single woman to be able to do strength training. And it can start with bodyweight exercises. If you're at home in a pandemic and you can't go to the gym, then just actually learning how to do some basic bodyweight exercises can be a great entry point. And I don't mean jumping around doing burpees. I mean, like, actually learning how to feel strong in a movement, like doing a push-up against a kitchen counter, doing some squats, like in the kitchen when you're just making dinner, like see how that feels to do a full range of motion going all the way down and all the way back up again. Do some lunges, see how that feels. Most people don't like do that. You don't have to jump up and down as well. I mean, it's just not necessary. So actually see what it feels like to actually put strain on the body in a really healthy, productive way. And then if you want to do a class, a body pump is a great introduction. And I think that what happens is if you continue to do body pump classes, they'll start to get easier, because you don't tend to change the weight very often. And it usually is like really high rep that you do, like lots of repetitions. And so curiosity builds. And so I think what women can do then is maybe think, oh, if I had a pair of dumbbells at home, what could I do with that? And then if you start to do your dumbbells and you do your squats in the kitchen with your dumbbells, or you do your lunges with dumbbells, you've added a little bit more load to the exercise. And so it doesn't have to be rocket science. You can just maybe do 2 or 3 exercises a day just to start and just to feel. And most women will like get a little bit sore and think, oh, Jesus, I didn't expect it to hurt so much. But it sort of tells me you're doing something right, but you also shouldn't be so sore that you can't sit down on the loo either, right? You need to find the balance so that you're not crippled for today's on. And that's serving nobody at all.
So one of the things that you explain in your book, which would be good, I think, to explain, because it sounds like an easy, doable thing, is this NEAT, N-E-A-T, so non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So this is a theory which, for those women who are complete beginners to movement, maybe who've just lost their mojo around exercise, who just don't want to do it. Explain to me, because I quite liked this theory.
Yeah, so I mean, I get there are days where you're I've been there myself, like we all have, lying on the sofa, feeling like crap and just not being able to do anything, right? It's just a horrible place to be. And we've sort of all been there. And the last thing we want to do is go and exercise. Or we physically can't, like there's a limitation on how we're feeling. And I know that a movement-filled life is more fulfilling than a sedentary-based life. We know that. And we also know for our health. And so need the non exercise activity part of your day is everything outside of exercise, right? So it's the movement we do every day. It's doing your housework. It's running up and down the stairs after the kids. It's like hoovering, anything you think about, the movement you do that isn't exercise. That's so beneficial to your body. And it actually is one of the part of the lion's share of the calories that you burn during the day. That's what thermogenesis means. That's the calories that the heat that we burn. And so I recommend everybody move every day. And by moving every day, I mean, get outside and just walk around the garden. If you're feeling so terrible that you just can't exercise at all, even just getting outside in nature, which is also a boost to our sort of like energy levels as well, just go for a little walk. You'll be surprised how good you feel afterwards. And so every day I recommend that women do something that's movement filled. And it's a really great first step. Like I speak to women that are like, they haven't exercised for years and they want to start doing something. And I'm like, okay, every day commit to walking for 15 minutes. Get off the bus a few stops earlier and walk into work. Honestly, it's a bit of a game changer, but it also has so many benefits to your overall health.
What about food? Because obviously that's a huge area that sits alongside. And I'm sure with strength training muscle, there's a requirement for protein, etc. What are your kind of absolute givens or things that you would advise your clients to be doing on the food front?
Women through menopause and generally through aging need to prioritize protein. So that's my number one thing. Make sure at every single meal protein. And the benefits of protein are amazing. Like, so first of all, it's our building block, right? It's the thing that builds and maintains our body. So it's like the queen of all of the nutrients. So
it's meat. What else is it?
Well, protein is in most foods. It's even in some vegetables, but it's primarily in order, like rank order. You will find it in meat, fish, dairy, and then it's in all grains, but in a smaller amount, and then also a smaller amount in vegetables. But the complete proteins, because there's loads of different breakdowns of proteins, are going to be in your meats and fishes. And another place that you can get it is in things like whey powder, you know, like protein shakes. You can add some whey powder to it. So that's another place you can get it. But it also helps women when they get that 3 o'clock slump where they go and get their muffin, you know, and a cup of tea and a muffin.
You're looking at me and you're thinking hobnobs.
It's the hobnob hour, right? That happens. And there's nothing wrong with having the hobnob hour. But the chances are, if you've had protein at your previous meals, that your blood sugar won't dip as much because it helps.
Are you telling me if I eat protein in the morning, I won't want a hobnob or six?
Well, you won't desperately stuff it down your face in like... You
know. I just have yogurt for breakfast, so...
Well, the thing is, yogurt's got protein in it as well, right? But I mean, it's just finding that you're slumping or you've got that, like you feel that you're getting a little bit hypoglycemic, like your blood sugar's dropping. Well, protein helps maintain that. So like I'll say to women, if like have your hobnob, but why don't you have some protein with it? Like, why don't you have some like sliced ham with it? It doesn't really go, I know, hobnobs and sliced ham, but you know. There's a protein with it. It's just one of those nutrients.
But it's all you make it quite clear in the book, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very helpful.
It shouldn't be difficult to do. And women are also being told all the time to avoid carbs. And it's so distressing for me to hear this. Like, and it's also like the way that people use the word carb is like an evil cousin to all of the other foods. And I'm just like, there's a huge gap in the knowledge base about what carbs are. And I find it like disheartening to hear, but women don't stop eating carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are the main fuel for your body. It's what keeps you going, and it also fuels your brain. You've got brain fog. You need to be eating your vegetables and your grains. I mean, that's a carbohydrate.
Mm. You live in North America. You live in Texas. Menopause in the States, midlife women, is it a kind of different ball game to the UK? What's different about it? What's the same?
I think
because I know that junk food and the weight thing is a big issue.
Yeah.
Like I think we're at 40-50% obesity, I think, over here. The conversation in the UK, it's crazy, right? Like menopause is everywhere. It's on national news. Mm-hmm. It's in the UK. papers. And, you know, like, I just think that 10 years ago, I'd never heard the word perimenopause. And now it's like everywhere. It's amazing. And it should be this way because there's a knowledge gap out there that, and we don't speak about it, right? It's way behind in the States. And I think that that seems to be a natural progression in everything in life. I mean, I lived in Canada most of my time in North America, and the conversation is happening there. I was on CBC, which is like the BBC, talking about menopause. And I was like, wow, I never thought that would happen. And so we're way behind in the conversation. There's a lot of misinformation out here. And there's a lot of people like marketing towards menopausal women. Yeah. And it's really upsetting to see them selling supplements and diets that really don't have a lot of evidence behind them. I'm a bit vocal about it. I don't know if you follow me, but I'm always calling people out. Yeah.
We all are. Hopefully that's the only way to get the message out. The book is full of all the studies. You know, absolutely know your stuff technically and scientifically, but you personally, how much do you work out now? What is your routine? Because you look fit, Amanda.
You know, I don't do any more than I say in the book. I do 3 strength training workouts a week, maybe 4, depending on my energy. I'm very flexible with my attitude to exercise. I do believe that just like the compounded effect of exercise is has been shown to be most beneficial. So it's not that you have to go full on hardcore in the beginning. Start small. Think of the snowball. Like, I do like to do running and swimming. I mean, we might talk about that. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually count those as my exercise days. I count those as like my like sanity days. You can call them whatever you want, but my workout days are the ones that I feel are like the main big rocks that I want to move. And then anything else I do is supplementary, and it's usually for my like mental well-being, actually.
I think that's the thing about exercise, isn't it? Because I've been doing some stuff with a charity called Women in Sport, and we're trying to change the conversation to it not being exercise. So it really puts a lot of women off if they feel like they've got to exercise as opposed to have a swim, enjoy a swim, or maybe just go for a run that doesn't have to be 5K. It's all this counting of it, measuring it, all of that. Do you think it's possible to change that attitude as a woman?
Oh, yes, I do. And I think that I call those ones, like a walk, run, a one. I go for a one sometimes instead of a run. And like I never would have done that in my 20s, but sometimes I'll go out just to get away from all of the males in my house because I'm like, overwhelmed by them. And I'll go for a run and I'll just think, I need to walk. So I'll walk and I don't care. But when I was in my 20s, I'm a total A-type personality. I would have felt like a failure. So I think with age, we definitely change our attitude from like doing exercise to look good to doing exercise to be healthy. And I think that that's a bit of a part of the conversation. And then I also encourage people that follow me to do fitness snacking, so they don't feel like they have to like have this like 1 hour put aside every day. I'm like, why don't you just do like a little bit here and a little bit there just until you see how it feels? Like do 10 minutes. You know that it's going to take 10 minutes for the potatoes to boil. So why don't you do something then? Like just fit it in, or find a friend and just say, right, let's get on Zoom quickly and let's do like 10 push-ups, 10 squats. And then we'll sit and like 3 times and see how that feels. Like just do something rather than nothing. It doesn't have to be so prescriptive. Our lives are just not prescriptive. We just can't be that way.
I think that's really good advice, don't you, Trish?
Yeah, very good advice for this new year. We're at the beginning of January, new year episode. So that is going to help so many women, I think, get their 2021s and become really strong. Thank you so much, Amanda. It's been so lovely to talk to you across the oceans. And we wish you all the best for 2021.
Thank you. Yes, it's made me homesick.
Coming up later, we have How to Win at Midlife, in which we aim to get our finances in order, and we'll be ending the show, as always, with our nostalgia noodles. Now, though, it's dilemma time, and this week we have been inspired by another Facebook post. This is from Catherine, who says, I've been reading a novel where the female 50-plus main character has a sexual encounter with a man who is not her husband. He expresses surprise that she continues to have pubic hair. I know the young prefer the smooth, waxed arrangement in Ladytown, but has this practice of trimming those bushes reached those of us in middle age? I'm in the process of a divorce and who knows, one day might find a new partner. Is this really the new norm? So Lorraine, what would you do in that situation? Hairless or hairy?
I'm slightly troubled by the use of the word Ladytown.
Lady Garden.
What I would say, I mean, I could go many places with that. But what I would say, dear Catherine, on Facebook, who cares what he thinks?
Yes.
This is about your lady town, not his lady town. And you can do with your lady town what you want to do with your lady town. Mm-hmm. Trish, have you ever had a Brazilian?
Oh, my God. You know, once and once only and never again is all I can say. I'm just going to say prickly regrowth. That's it.
I feel like we should mention Margot at this point. I don't know why. We're going to talk about Trish's pussy.
She's a fluffy pussy. Is
She's so hairy, isn't she? She's so hairy.
Just lowering the tone, Lorraine.
I can't help it.
You're obsessed.
Don't wax it unless you want to. Wax it if you do want to. It's such a personal thing, isn't it? And to get drawn into what is expected, I think we don't care what is expected. We just care that we're happy with it ourselves. Now we've reached the How to Win at Midlife section of the show. This is where we bring you practical advice from an expert. So pen and paper at hand, because this one is important.
Yes, we're going to be tackling family finances and midlife money worries, which I think most of us have at some point or another.
Always.
And to do this, Lorraine, you went straight to the top, didn't you? And you spoke to a really inspiring CEO who shook up the fintech world in her 50s. She raised $48 million to launch an award-winning bank.
Yes, that's right. I chatted with the Starling Bank CEO, Anne Bowden, who is now 60, and she is such a force of nature when it comes to advising women on money. So brace yourself. It's quite good advice, but it requires a change of mindset. So she says that when you hit 40, you do need to review your spending and define your kind of future expectations, the future things you want to spend your money on. And she said the number one thing to do is to change the way you think about money as a woman in midlife. She says you really need to inspire yourself to take an interest in your finances. Well, in finances generally, actually. And this would mean really engaging with the money bits of the paper, really engaging with the money bits of magazines, following online money sites, you know, maybe looking at books that simplify how to spring clean your finances. But she says it's about making money a hobby.
And I think because we are talking about money right now, because we don't talk about money, do we? I mean, I don't really talk about money with
British.
My friends.
Is it?
Exactly. And that's another thing, really, that is part of sticking our heads in the sand. But we should be asking, especially our savvy friends, where are they investing their money? Have they got ISAs? What are they doing? And hopefully they'll want to share that.
It's a very odd thing, isn't it? I've got a friend who's an accountant, but she's a very close friend. And at no point in the whole of our friendship have I ever asked her for money advice. And I was driving back from somewhere in the car the other day talking about our changing finances with my new. She said, well, why haven't you asked me about it? I am an accountant.
Oh, wow.
But it wouldn't cross my mind. So it's a very un-British thing. So, so do ask around. You will
know someone,
I think. And also, how do people put family finances together? People will have lots of different plans. I think it's well worth doing that. And also worth looking at how you're spending. Are you competitively spending? That's a question Anne says you need to ask yourself. So if you've got friends who are leading a much more exotic, glamorous life, are you spending to keep up? Perhaps you should spend to keep up with the friends who lead less of the glamorous life, but probably just as exciting a life. Don't copy other people's decisions. Look at what other people are doing and talk to them about it.
Yeah. And it's thinking about money, what you're spending and what are you getting from that? Is it how are you responding emotionally to what it is that you're spending? Are these things giving you pleasure? Is where you're putting your money giving you pleasure? And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, actually, rather than thinking, well, I have to spend that and I have to buy that, or I'm just going to save everything and I'm never going to buy myself anything because I'm too worried about what's going to happen in a year's time. You know, it's kind of just having a bit more of a relaxed attitude.
It's the emotional feedback loop, isn't it, on what you spend and what you don't spend. If you perhaps write down what it all makes, you'll see in front of you the picture of what is important to you and what is not important to you. She also says that you do need to be on top of your spending, but you don't need to kind of micromanage it. There doesn't need to be. See, this is what frightens me. My husband, I have a bit of a head in the sand attitude. He does manage the finances, and he manages it with spreadsheets and things like that. So the moment I see all of that, I have to go and stand with my face against a wall and pretend that I'm invisible.
Yeah, exactly.
I just can't do numbers on a spreadsheet. Well, you've Google Drived me, haven't you, already this morning?
Well, exactly. I had to sort you out, didn't I? So do you never know at all what's going on? So you leave it totally to him? Because I do think you should know a bit.
Well, now I'm in charge more of my finances as a freelance person. Mm-hmm. I have taken Anne's advice and looked into it. I have downloaded all the apps that I hadn't got downloaded, and it's actually so much easier than I thought it would be. I can be aware of what's going where and move stuff around quite easily and see what's coming in and out. I think you then begin to sort of keep that in your head. So yes, I'm less head in the sand than I was, but it's just not my favourite thing. But I think once you get to midlife, you start having to do a lot of things that are not your favourite things, or what, because life changes and your situation changes. So if you don't know about the money, you're slightly, it's perplexing. You lose your choices, don't you, your future choices. So Anne also says that when you do this annual tax return, whether you do it with your advisor or whether you do it yourself, in that month, in that January, now is the time to do it. Sit down with the family and talk about what everyone wants to do this year that's going to cost money, and what we could perhaps stop doing, and what our expectations are for the year. Don't leave it later than that, she said, because then you lose the chance to work out and plan how you get to where you want to be.
Yeah, I like that idea of like bringing the kids into it, so they see the responsibility as well of you making conscious decisions about where the money goes, and they need to be aware of that. Yeah, that's a very, very good lesson.
Well, I hope you found that helpful. I really enjoyed interviewing Anne over the phone. Her career is amazing. She has actually written a book about her career. It's called Banking on It: How I Disrupted an Industry. And she really did, in her mid-50s, in her midlife, turn the tech world around. And you know, fintech is very young and cool, and she was a midlife woman doing it. So, and that she runs a Starling bank. So thanks, Anne, and I hope that was helpful. Okay, Trish, we are now at nostalgia noodling, possibly my favourite part of the show. What have you been nostalgic about this week?
Well, it's something quite soft and fluffy and...
my bloody cat.
Bedroom related. Do you remember candlewick bedspreads?
Oh, God, yes.
Do you remember those?
I wanted one. They weren't quite comfortable.
They still sell them. It's quite strange. But yes, we had them in our house. And they're kind of like a sort of weird chenille type of embroidery, very sort of in a dusky pink I'm making it probably sound nicer than it actually is. But the reason, shall I tell you why I thought about candlewick bedspreads, is that... when I was seven. Trish. That's when we had them.
Because we
were very much a sort of sheets and scratchy blankets kind of family with a candlewick. Do you remember when we first heard about quilts? They were called continental quilts.
My mum was very anti the continental quilt. She used to say, so unhygienic. And I think, how can they be? How can they be compared to sheets?
To the scratchy blanket and then the candlewick bedspreads, which I suppose these days they'd be called a throw, wouldn't they? Which is much, much nicer than a bedspread. But just very quickly, the thing that reminded me of it, and this was the Small Axe series that Steve McQueen did of films about sort of black history and black community experiences that were on the BBC before Christmas, which I absolutely loved. I thought they were amazing. But the most amazing thing was the attention to detail of all the styling. And of course, there were candlewick bedspreads. There were Pyrex dishes. And actually, Neil and I spent most of the episodes going, oh, look at that. It's a glass dolphin. We had one of those. It was so brilliant. But the thing that stood out for me was that the candlewick bedspread. Yes, that was a nice little one. But what about you? Where have you been being
feeling nostalgic?
Well, it's
been very exciting because it allows me to be a giant show-off once again.
Oh, it's not another name drop.
Massive name drop. So my 16-year-old has been redoing her bedroom, particularly her bedroom walls, and been putting up her posters. And she's been putting up band posters. And I thought, well, how lovely. Mm. We all had band posters, didn't we, in the 80s?
Yes, we did.
George, Kid Creole for me.
Yeah, Wham.
The big one she's put up, which was a real surprise to me, right in the middle, is the Pink Floyd, the wall one, which is like the Scream picture. It's kind of really dramatic. It's a slightly scary. She has a very dark mind. Feels to her. Anyway, it reminded me of a very fabulous dinner with Ralph Lauren.
Oh, yes.
In London.
Yes.
Where I sat next to a man called Nick.
Mm.
And we chatted and chatted and chatted and chatted. And he said he worked in the music industry. And he was very, very nice, quite a little bit older than me.
Oh, no, obviously. I think I know where this is going.
No, he then said to me, because he was doing cooking and blah, blah, blah. He said, I'm going to write a cookbook called The Dark Side of the Spoon.
Nice.
Not a titter was raised.
Oh, because you didn't even know what that was.
I looked at him blankly and said,
oh, God, oh, rain.
Really, is it chocolate that you like or is it... And as we were leaving, I said, I am so sorry, but I don't know what you do. And he said, oh, well, I'm Nick Mason. I'm a Nick drummer Mason. In a band called Pink Floyd.
That
was so lovely as well. Oh. So normal and down to earth. Oh. Anyway, copyright that, Dark Side of the Spoon.
Well, and were you horrifically embarrassed and ashamed of your behaviour?
Grovelled. But then, of course, my mind went completely blank and I couldn't remember any Pink Floyd.
Oh,
just couldn't remember any of them. And then was worried I was going to say something that Metallica or someone had done and get wrong and it'd be even more insulting. So it was just very nice to see that retro band poster.
Yes. Oh, well, now I know what to buy you for your birthday present. Copy of that cookbook.
Well, if you bring my memory back, would be quite good.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be good. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Postcards from Midlife. Thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed it, please tell all your friends and the midlife women you know. And remember to subscribe on your podcast provider. And it would be super helpful if you could rate and review us there too.
And don't forget to join us on our Facebook group, on Instagram, or you can email us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. Goodbye.
Bye.